Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. According to the CDC, heart disease is the leading cause of death for women. In fact, heart disease kills more women than all types of cancer combined. Over 60 million women in the U.S. are living with some form of heart disease, and understanding the risk factors and warning signs are key to catching it early. Joining us to talk about heart disease is cardiologist Dr. Alyssa Thompson. Welcome.
Thank you.
Also with us is Ann Sarno. She's one of Dr. Thompson's patients who was diagnosed with heart disease. Welcome, Ann.
Thank you.
All right, so I think many listeners will be shocked to learn that heart disease kills more women than all cancers combined. That sounds so shocking. There's this perception that men are at great risk. We know we see in the movies and films men having heart attacks, but we don't see that happening to women. Dr. Thompson, why do you think we more strongly associate heart disease with men rather than women?
Well, I think there are a variety of different reasons that this unfortunate misconception exists and persists. I think that we are very good in our country at advising women and empowering women about their own health in terms of breast cancer. The initiatives by the Susan G. Komen Foundation in the early 1990s about breast self-examination and mammography really put a dent in breast cancer morbidity and mortality. And although more people have died every year of heart disease than every single cancer combined since penicillin was discovered,
wow.
And more women have died than men every year from heart attacks since 1994, we are not, I think, very good at announcing this to women. But I think the bigger issue is we're not very good at making people aware, whether they're women or men, and that we are all at very high risk for cardiovascular morbidity, like a heart attack or having to have a stent or having to have bypass surgery or stroke, and mortality. And so I think that as a whole, we in the United States need to become more aware and vocal about risk factors before they become an unstoppable process that leads to a preventable cardiovascular event.
Now, a woman's heart attack warning signs can be different than a men's. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, the typical chest pain description of burning or pain in the middle of the chest was described more than 100 years ago in Baltimore among male chimney sweeps. So many people have different symptoms, and women can have more subtle symptoms. They can typically have more fatigue with exertion or nausea or pain in other parts of their body, like their neck or their left arm. So it's not always the typical mid-sternal chest pain that drives women to think that they're having a heart attack. And so because those symptoms aren't always the typical symptoms, if you will, even when women present to the ER, for example, they're not as frequently immediately driven to a heart attack type protocol. There's usually a delay because these symptoms are less typical, if you will.
And when did you become aware that you were having cardiac issues? You know, what were your symptoms?
So for me, excuse me, it began in 2017. I was a little bit typical. Mine was pressure in my sternum area. It felt like I swallowed a tangerine kind of thing. There was just this lump that I couldn't shake. Easily winded on really minimal exertion. And at the time I had a primary care annual coming up in 2 or 3 weeks. And I was like, okay, we'll talk about it then. And as soon as I went to primary care, they're like, okay,
and you're breaking up a little bit. Why don't you turn off your video? Maybe we'll be able to not have you freeze up on
us.
Yeah.
I decided I needed 5 stents at that time.
Oh, do you have a family history of heart disease? And if so, were you?
I do. Yeah. My mother passed away at 62 and my brother passed away at 53. So I definitely have that in my background.
Yeah. Dr. Thompson, talk about the genetic risks of heart disease.
Sure. So for Anne in particular, because she has a history of primary relatives with premature events, that gives her extra risk. So most of us have a family member who's had a cardiovascular event, but because Anne's mother had an event before she was 65 and her brother had an event before he was 55, those are specific non-modifiable risk factors that are Anne's and Anne's alone. So there are, the way I look at it is like family history of skin cancer. Okay. That, so this is something that's really helpful, I think, for my patients to understand. If you have a family history of skin cancer, that means that your skin is more susceptible to the negative radiation effects from the sun. Okay. But none of us are safe from the sun, and none of us should go out and get a sunburn. But for Anne's family, they're more susceptible to this. All of us have the same response and same inflammatory issues as we age in skin versus our arteries, right? So sunlight is to the skin and skin cancer as animal fat, animal protein, and hyper-processed foods are to our endothelium, which is the lining of the arteries that where the inflammation occurs that creates arterial disease. And so understanding her familial history should then drive Anne's understanding of the other things that she can control, what she's eating, her blood sugar, her blood pressure, her cholesterol. Those are all modifiable risk factors that we all should be looking at, even if we don't have a family predisposition.
Yeah. Are there genetic tests, like there are for, cancer? Are there some tests for heart disease that people can do to
Well, there's
understand this?
not, we don't do genetic testing because most people in our country have some development of heart disease in their adulthood. This inflammatory process starts when we're children, and it progresses throughout the decades of our lives. So it's not genetic testing, it's awareness of the risk factors that go into worsening inflammation. So knowing your family history, did a female relative, a primary female relative, your mother, your sister, have a heart attack before age 65? Did a primary male relative have a cardiovascular event before age 55? Do you have hypertension, right? Hypertension is exceptionally common and it's a significant risk factor for cardiovascular disease. So if you have hypertension, you're at risk for a heart attack. Hypercholesterolemia, if you have high blood cholesterol levels, that's another risk factor for a cardiovascular event. If you have high blood sugar, if you have impaired fasting glucose or diabetes, that's a very severe inflammatory disease that leads to heart attack and stroke and heart failure. If you have obstructive sleep apnea, that puts you at risk. If you have obesity or overweight, those are again significant inflammatory problems, metabolically speaking, that put you at risk for a cardiovascular event. So it's actually more of an awareness of all of these individual risk factors that people need to take stock of.
Yeah. And prior to the span of cardiac events that you experienced, can you describe your lifestyle? What was your lifestyle like?
At the time I was working full time and in office situation, so pretty sedentary during the day. I was a moderate exerciser. I walked, nothing strenuous, but I was a good walker multiple times a week. That was about the level of my exercise
Yeah.
at that time.
We'll get to changes in a couple of minutes, but Dr. Thompson, heart attacks are what most people think of when they hear heart disease, but the term heart disease encompasses, right, a range of conditions. So let's start with coronary artery disease. What is it, and what are some of the symptoms?
So coronary artery disease is an an inflammatory disorder of the artery walls of your heart. So the coronary arteries are the blood vessels that supply the muscle of the left ventricle with blood. And you can have asymptomatic coronary heart disease. So many people come to my office because they had a CAT scan of their chest for a different reason, and they find out that there are calcified plaques in their arteries. So that's coronary heart disease. They may not have had a heart attack. They may not have had to have a stent or bypass, but they do have evidence of this decades-long inflammatory disorder of their arteries. And we need to adjust their medications on many occasions and their lifestyle so that we can help prevent an event from happening. We want to stabilize that inflammatory plaque and make sure that it doesn't progress and cause a heart attack or progress and cause abnormal blood flow to the muscle of the heart.
So some of the symptoms of that might be shortness of breath, pain in the neck, jaw, throat, upper belly or back, pain, numbness, excuse me, and
That's
then
okay.
this chest pain
Or
or
no
chest,
symptoms at
or
all.
no
That's
symptoms
the
at
whole
all,
thing.
right?
Is that that's the issue is that many people go along and have this ongoing throughout the decades of their lives, and they don't realize it, and they're not aware because it doesn't cause symptoms until it's a problem. And so when it's a problem, then it can cause shortness of breath with exertion. It can cause fatigue, unusual fatigue with exertion. It can cause chest pain, chest pressure, nausea. Many different types of symptoms when we're trying to exercise or exert ourselves, and the heart needs more blood flow to increase our cardiac output to do this exercise, for example. Like Anne was explaining, when she was trying to do things and she was feeling the sense of a tangerine in her throat, that's when it becomes symptomatic, when blood flow is being impaired.
So does angina come under this category?
Angina is it just means pain. So it's the typical pain caused by a blockage in blood flow to the left ventricle.
I remember my grandmother with her little bottle of nitroglycerin, right, that she would carry around in her pocket for her angina, right? All right. Irregular heartbeat, that can also be a symptom of heart disease. Is this something we might notice, or is it more subtle? What should we take notice of when it comes to heartbeats?
Anytime you feel that your heart is beating irregularly, it could mean that you're just having palpitations. You might have had increased stress, or you didn't sleep so well, or you aren't drinking enough water, for example. Or you can have abnormal heart rhythms that could mean that there's an abnormal blood flow. So, anytime you're feeling those types of symptoms, it's always important at least to speak with your primary care physician and maybe see a cardiologist so that we can determine what these symptoms might represent.
Right. The heart muscle itself can also become diseased. What causes this and what are the symptoms there?
So the heart muscle can become dysfunctional for a variety of different reasons. If you have a heart attack and part of the heart muscle dies in the left ventricle, you can be at risk for heart failure. The heart muscle doesn't recover after that. If you drink too much alcohol or use drugs, that can cause heart failure because it affects the muscle abnormally, and there's a toxic exposure. People who have chemotherapy for certain types of cancers can have toxicity to their heart muscle cells because of the chemotherapy itself. So we have to be very vigilant about that in certain circumstances with certain very specific chemotherapy agents. Diabetes causes direct damage to the heart muscle cells. So any person who has diabetes is at risk for developing heart failure just because they have diabetes. People who have obstructive sleep apnea can, develop some very significant problems with the left ventricle if they don't have appropriate or aggressive treatment, sometimes because the sleep apnea leads to low oxygen levels that can damage the heart. If you have anemia, that can damage the heart. Iron deficiency. There's so many
Oh, so it's
different
a lot,
types of
right?
diseases. Exactly.
And what about the heart valves? They can also sometimes not be functioning correctly, right? So how is this diagnosed?
The heart valve abnormalities are diagnosed specifically with a test called an echocardiogram. Heart valve abnormalities can be something that we're born with. It can be something that happens over time. Sometimes, when people have had radiation, for example, for breast cancer on the left side, or other reasons to have radiation to the chest, can develop heart valve abnormalities just because of the exposure to the radiation. Age can cause heart valve abnormalities. So we have a clinic in at Cape Cod Healthcare for aortic stenosis, which is something where the aortic valve becomes very sticky and very thickened over time and with age. And so we see it in our older population, and it's something that's very typical on Cape Cod because we have an older population here. So we see that a lot, and it's an age-related disease.
Those echocardiograms are really interesting. It's like, you know, all the, I guess it's the colors, like telling you where the blood is flowing. It almost reminds me of the weather maps, like the Doppler weather. I mean, is it that similar technology?
It's literally Doppler.
No,
We're
it
using
is.
Doppler assessment to look at where blood is flowing. So we use the same color schematic as the weatherman to look at the blood as it flows across the valves and through the chambers of the heart.
Yeah, it can be quite shocking. I'm just thinking of my own, a very mild thing, but a heart thing that I never knew I had. I'd been to a cardiologist, but just the technology now, what they're able to tell. And I was really surprised when my cardiologist said, "You were probably born with it." So I've had this my whole life and never knew it, right? So I wonder how many times you tell patients, "Well, here's what's going on," and they're like, "What? How am
Yeah,
I just finding out now?" Right?
it happens all the time that, you know, I had a patient this morning who has something going on with her that she was born with 72 years ago, and her primary care physician heard a murmur, did an echocardiogram, and now we see this thing that never caused a problem in her whole entire life, and she was dumbfounded to find out she was born with it. And you know, it's We don't need to screen for these things. There's all sorts of, you know, different variations of normal that are around. So it's only when there is a problem that we get concerned and we need to adjust medications sometimes, or sometimes we need to have surgical interventions. And you know, we're very fortunate on Cape Cod to have a wonderful structural heart team and cardiac surgery center where we can repair and replace these valves if need be.
And were you surprised when you found out what was going on with your heart, or did you think, ah, oh, this makes sense?
Well, excuse me, because of my family background, I was not surprised. You know, I kind of always knew it was coming, you know. So it wasn't a surprise. It was not fun to hear that the reality had caught up with me, but yeah, I wasn't outrageously surprised.
Yeah. So, Dr. Thompson, now with somebody with a history in their family like Anne, I imagine the rest of Anne's family is going, okay, maybe we all need to kind of check this out, right? So, if you have a history like that, it's worth what, talking to your primary care about it?
Yeah, absolutely. First, talk to your primary care. Talk to them about your other risk factors, your family history. What's my blood sugar doing? Are you concerned about my cholesterol? You know, kind of talking to them about those basic risk factors and really taking stock of them. And then always see a cardiologist. If you ever have any concerns, or if your primary care has any concerns, it's always best to see a cardiologist because we can really drill down on what your risk factors are and how very specifically we can adjust those risk factors or manage those risk factors before it leads to an event.
Right. We're talking about heart disease this morning, particularly in women, with cardiologist Dr. Alyssa Thompson and Anne Sarna, one of Dr. Thompson's patients. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about heart disease this morning, particularly in women, with cardiologist Dr. Alyssa Thompson and Anne Sarna, one of Dr. Thompson's patients who was diagnosed with heart disease. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Dr. Thompson, we're talking about Anne's family history and having that knowledge going in to see your primary care. But what about folks who may not know about their family's medical history? You know, some folks who are adopted who have absolutely no idea what their family history might be.
It happens. It happens very frequently that we have patients who come in who don't know their biological family history, and we just unfortunately have to adjust for that and just drill down on the modifiable risk factors that we can address. And you know, family history is important in the sense that we need to know if you have it because we have to be it's another set of risks. But if we don't, then we just treat you like everybody else, you know, and we want to know again these modifiable risk factors. do you have them and how can we modify them and be just as aggressive? But yeah, it's very difficult for patients who have been adopted because there's so many different familial issues that we now know we can address, just like cancers or heart disease. But it's important to understand that just because we don't know somebody's biologic family history doesn't mean that we shouldn't be any less aggressive.
So what about high blood pressure? Is that a risk factor or a symptom of heart disease?
High blood hypertension, the disease hypertension, is a risk factor for cardiovascular disease. Hypertension, our blood pressures rise as we age. Our blood vessels become less elastic and stiffer, and so our blood pressure will naturally rise as we age. So a normal blood pressure for a 90-year-old person is very different from a normal blood pressure for a 20-year-old person. Unfortunately, in our country, hypertension, the disease, is typically and most specifically driven by overconsumption of sodium. And so when we have high blood pressure for any reason, but in particular sodium consumption, it causes a lot of stress at the level of the artery walls that drives this inflammatory process that leads to heart disease.
So we discussed some of the different forms of heart disease. Are there certain forms that are more common in women than men?
Well, yes. Heart attack is and cardiac disease death is more common in women than men. I mean, it's common in both women and men, but unfortunately, it is clearly more common in women. Again, the mortality rate from heart attack has been higher in women than men since
And all
1994.
types of heart conditions, not just any one in
Well,
particular.
no, I mean there are, congenital diseases that are, sometimes more common in women than men or more common in men than women. There are some types of cardiomyopathies, which is a type of abnormality of the heart muscle cells that can become more common in women than men or vice versa. So typically it's just unfortunate that heart attack and death from heart attack is much more common in women than men, although too common in both
Both people,
women and
yeah.
men.
Are there routine screenings or blood work that a woman should have to help identify heart disease risk? When you're going in for your, usually before you go your annual exam, you get some blood work done. Is there anything in particular we should be asking for?
Right now, we want to know about your glucose levels. So we want a fasting glucose, a hemoglobin A1C, which is a blood test that tells us how high your blood sugar might be over a long-term period of time. We want to know what your kidney function is. We want to know what your cholesterol is, your total cholesterol, your HDL cholesterol. Those are the numbers. Cardiologists can use different calculators and that include your age and your gender and your body mass index and your zip code, for example, and those lab values. And so on a daily basis, when I see my patients who are at risk for heart disease, I kind of use those specific labs to fit into my calculator. But just getting those checked once a year with your primary care physician and getting your blood pressure checked when you go see your primary care physician at least once a year, I think are the most important ways that we can determine where your risk lies.
High cholesterol is an issue for a lot of folks. Can it be controlled with changes to diet alone, or does it take more than that?
So that's a great question. So if you have high cholesterol, maybe your cholesterol is high because your triglycerides are high or your LDL is high, or sometimes people have high HDL. The HDL is the good cholesterol. So there's a lot of different things that can drive high cholesterol. It is important to change your diet always. You want to make sure that you're consuming as little processed carbohydrate as you can. So overconsumption of hyper-processed foods is a problem that's driving diabetes and obesity, but also high triglycerides and high cholesterol. So eliminating as much of the processed food or refined carbohydrate from our diet is really important. It's important to try to limit your exposure to animal fat and animal protein of any sort. So not just red meat, but having less meat and more veggie meals is very, very important as well.
ultra-processed foods is a relatively new term, right? But I guess the simplest way to think about it is foods that are made from ingredients we don't have at home, right? Emulsifiers, preservatives, multiple sweeteners. I mean, you look at the label and there's all these chemicals that you can't even pronounce, right? These foods are linked to heart disease, right? Is it because of the high blood pressure? I mean, do we know why, what they're doing in the heart that creates this risk?
Well, I think that it's important just for me to add, it's not just a risk for heart disease. Diabetes and obesity those epidemics are being driven by these types of foods as well. And because they contain a lot of sodium, hypertension is driven by these foods. And all of those things are risk factors for heart disease. So it's a very complex sort of intertwined issue, mm-hmm. but the fact that these, emulsifiers and preservatives and, sodium salts are in such high concentration in these foods, and there's very little nutritional value to these foods, affects every organ system in our body, and it doesn't allow our heart to use energy as efficiently, just like every other organ system in our body, and it affects the basic biochemistry of how cells function. Mm-hmm. So it's a very, very complex issue, but we know in so many different ways how very inflammatory pathways are turned on in our bodies when we consume these inflammatory types of micro and macronutrients, and how many important biochemical pathways are turned off. And I think that's one of the reasons that the new medications, the GLP-1 receptor agonist therapies like Wegovy and Ozempic and Mounjaro and Zepbound are so important, because they really attack the root biochemical pathways that are causing all of these problems to interact and lead to the diseases that I treat, such as ischemic heart disease.
I think when folks are in the grocery store, if they really start looking at the labels, it takes me a long time to grocery shop now because I look at the labels, but I think they would be shocked not only at the number of like chemical things that are in the labels, but also look at the sodium content and the sugar content, because I mean, what makes these foods taste good? Sodium and sugar, right? And I think people would be really surprised at how high these numbers can be.
Yeah, it happens all the time in my office. I get referrals for patients who have difficult to control blood pressure, and their primary care may be having difficulty with these patients on many medications, with their blood pressures all over the place. And they come to the office and we just talk about their nutrition, and we have a real frank discussion about their nutrition, and people tend to think they're eating much more healthfully than they really do. And it takes looking at labels and really cataloging and keeping a diary of what you're actually consuming to provide you with the reality of how much you're really exposing yourself to these toxic chemicals and how much excess sodium is really in your system at any time. And I've never had a patient come back to me after one of these conversations and say, nope, I was right on the target. I don't consume too much. So yeah. They always are, you know, in shock about how much sodium they've been consuming.
I have a niece who's a nurse, as a matter of fact, in a hospital in Connecticut on the cardiac floor. And she was visiting and we had bought this bacon that said lower sodium bacon. Well, she laughed out loud. She said, bacon, I don't care if it's a lower sodium. That thing is riddled with sodium.
It's lower than high.
Exactly. Which is still high.
It doesn't mean it's healthy for you. You're right. All right.
So we also know that exercise is important for overall health, but has increasing our physical activity been linked to reducing risk for heart disease? I'm assuming yes.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes. There's nothing bad. There's no bad part of exercise. There's just good in cardiovascular world. Activity is very important. We need to be active. We are not active as a society. We have desk jobs. We sit around. We play games on our computers. We watch TV. So there's an activity issue that is driving obesity and diabetes and heart disease. But then there's also exercise. And when we're exercising, it's a really exceptional physiologic state that drives anti-inflammatory mechanisms at the level of our artery walls that are very protective and can help improve the health and stability of our arteries. So it's really important to think about exercising. The United States Preventive Services Task Force recommends at least 2.5 hours of moderate intensity exertion a week. So that's a minimum. And moderate intensity exertion is characterized by your respiratory rate being so high that you couldn't really whistle or sing. You could say hey to a friend, but you couldn't carry on a conversation. So that's important to recognize that there is a minimum of this exertion that exists, and to protect us from cardiovascular illness.
And that's going to look different for different people. Anne mentioned before she was just pretty much maybe walking a little bit. And so as you start to increase your exercise, walking might make you winded, right? Until you so talk a little bit about as you begin these exercise programs, you don't all of a sudden want to go out there and, you know, be like a weekend warrior, right? I mean, you want to gradually increase, right?
Right. You want to protect your joints and your muscles, and you want to make sure you're stretching anytime you're doing exercising and warming up. But walking itself can be a great exercise. It's free. We have beautiful walking trails all over Cape Cod. We had a walking program, a partnership with the National Seashore for 10 years. That was a really beautiful program using the National Seashore facilities. You can get to a moderate intensity of exercise when you're walking. A lot of times I suggest to my patients, if they're out walking, they walk at a regular pace for 3 telephone poles, for example, and then the next 3 telephone poles go as fast as you physically can, mm-hmm. and kind of do interval training on your walk. I think that's a great way to start with exercise, just ramping yourself up so that you're doing more activity and interspersed with these intervals of high intensity exercise. But biking, all of that.
Yeah, I'll say, and the walking aspect, you're talking about some of these trails, National Seashore, that's also good for your brain, right? It's like a stress reducer. It's almost like a meditation when you're walking in some of these beautiful areas. And that uneven, you know, up and down, that's good for balance. So you're kind of, you know, killing birds with a stone.
Many
kind
birds.
Of, yeah, exactly. When you do that. What about strength training?
Strength training is very important, and for a huge variety of different reasons, especially for women. We want to make sure that we're doing strength training to avoid osteopenia and osteoporosis, which is, you know, can be a very severe disease and leads to fatality as well. So strength training is excellent for a variety of different reasons, and not to mention cardiovascular health. Strength training and conditioning keeps us active. So just as you were saying, walking is good for balance. Doing strength training and keeping our core muscles activated and fit is going to help improve our overall exertional tolerance and help us maintain exercise longer throughout our lives.
And we don't have to go to the gym to do that. I mean, you can, that's great, but I mean, you could just be like lifting some cans of beans, or like, I mean, there's things you have around the house that you could use without using a lot of gym equipment.
Right. Absolutely. And training, you know, just using your own body weight, you know, we've all seen people do planks and things, exercises like that. Not that they're fun. I don't really love doing it, but there's all sorts of ways that you can use your own body mass to do strength training. Pilates, yoga, Tai Chi, like all of those different exercises will also include strength training.
Right. And you said you were walking before you had your issues. What are you doing now exercise wise?
About the same. I'm not walking as frequently as I would like. You know, other issues crop up. I had a total knee replacement. Oh, so that has not helped me with my walking. But yeah, that's really what I still try to do. I do a little bit of strength training at home with weights. But mostly trying to get that walk in multiple times a week.
We're talking about heart disease this morning. 866-999-4626 is our number. If you'd like to join our conversation, that's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about heart disease this morning, particularly in women, with cardiologist Dr. Alyssa Thompson and Ann Sarna, one of Dr. Thompson's patients who was diagnosed with heart disease. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Earlier, we talked about genetic risks for heart disease, and I know the answer to that. Dr. Siddhartha is probably familiar to many of our listeners. We talk with him about plant-based diets, and I always, this just blows me away that there is evidence that lifestyle changes like diet and exercise can actually turn genes on and off. Talk about that, yes. Dr. Thompson.
Well, again, you know, talking about different biochemical cascades that are turned on and turned off by a variety of different biochemical interactions in our gut. I know Dr. Siddhartha talks a lot about the gut microbiome. The gut microbiome is an underappreciated part of our body. Anne can talk about this. Anne's one of my heroes because of what she's done with her dietary interventions. But yes, when we consume things that are highly processed or consume animal fats and animal proteins, there are biochemical compounds that are secreted in our gut by the gut microbiome that turn on different biochemical pathways, turn on and off different protective or harmful gene pathways. So it's very complex in terms of the biochemistry, but the interplay is real. Mm-hmm. And it is true that when we consume animal fat and animal protein, we are causing direct harm and inflammation at the level of our artery walls in our brains, causes diabetes and obesity. So it's well documented. But when we consume just plant-based sources, whole food plant-based sources of fats and proteins and complex carbohydrates, those pathways readjust. Mm. And so Anne has been incredible in terms of her attention to her diet and her practice of nutrition. And I think it has absolutely changed the course of her disease process and really significantly changed how bad things could be for Anne. All right. And I'll let Anne.
Yeah, I was gonna say, Anne, do tell. What have you done, Anne?
So I have gone to a plant-based diet. All of my heart issues, cardiac disease, was between 2017 and 2019, as far as having stents put in. So since 2019, with that plant-based diet and as much exercise as I physically can do, I have had no issues in those working on 6 years at this point. Everything's, you know, and for me, the diet was the one thing that I can control. Mm-hmm. I can't control my family history. You know, Dr. Thompson's in charge of controlling my blood pressure and, you know, high cholesterol with the various medications I'm on. But the one thing I can do three times a day is make decisions for my own health. And that's kind of empowering to feel yeah. like, you know, I have that choice myself and make a difference. Yeah. And it clearly has. I've had no issues in over 5 years.
How do you feel?
I feel good. Yeah, I feel good.
and how quickly did it make a difference for you?
So prior to that, I wasn't the worst nutrition patient in the world. I was a non-meat eater for 40 years at this point. So that wasn't the piece that I had to lose. I was pescatarian. I ate dairy and I ate fish. Mm-hmm. So I don't know that it was like an quick, instantaneous difference, but over that time of the first year or so, it would help me manage weight. It let me exercise fully. And I would say over that first year, there was a noticeable difference in my day-to-day health and feeling good about it.
Yeah. Dr. Thompson, how soon after making heart-healthy lifestyle modifications could we expect to see a positive impact on heart health?
We know experimentally that if you change your diet to a whole food plant-based diet in about 6 weeks, there are significant changes in the health of the gut microbiome and changes in what the gut microbiome is secreting and producing in terms of harmful versus helpful biochemical compounds. So it does happen quite quickly, and then it gets compounded over time, if that makes sense.
It's tough. I mean, this is not an easy change for a lot of people to go from, a diet that might not be so healthy into a plant-based diet. How do you help patients? I mean, is it a gradual thing? Do you start cutting out one thing? How do you help them get to that point?
I think, like Anne was saying, we try to help people become empowered because when you're empowered and when you understand, you're going to be more motivated to do more. And so there are, when we have patients who have had cardiovascular events, they go to cardiac rehabilitation. We're very fortunate in Hyannis, we have a full-time dietitian who explains and educates about plant-based dietary practices. But that's a very limited scope of people. I have a variety of different books and Netflix documentaries and websites. I try to give my patients as many resources as I can that I've vetted that I know are useful to me in my own daily life. We talk a lot about recipes. Some of my favorite resources for my patients are, in fact, cookbooks. Anne is an excellent resource. She always provides me with a special recipe every time I see her. So it and I think it's just important to help patients understand how to use the grocery store, that this is not intuitive, but it's not difficult. You don't have to shop for special things. You don't have to go to special stores to eat the foods that are necessary and important to you. We're very fortunate on Cape Cod that we have a variety of different organic farms. And in the summertime, we have farmers markets that, that's where the most nutritious food is. It comes from the ground, it's picked when it's actually ripe. So it has the most nutritious content that it can have. It wasn't picked months ago. And shipped here. So, it's important to just help people understand that it's right under your nose. It's right there, and we support it. I think, again, this theme of empowerment helps people not to be too scared of what it really means to pursue a plant-based diet, and that any change that you can make throughout your week, as Anne was saying, 3 times a day I have this opportunity. 3 times a day you have an opportunity. If you can make one change once a day, that's better than no changes. And I think, that's borne out by the science as well.
Are women
And
at
if I could just
a... Oh, go
add to
ahead,
that,
Anne.
Dr. Thompson, I was going to say, when I was in cardiac rehab, I think a lot of people were turned off of you hear plant-based and they're like, oh, I'm not doing that. I'm not eating tofu and brown rice. And, my sort of comment back to them was, have you ever had spaghetti with marinara sauce? Then you had a completely vegan meal that day. So just getting sort of the mainstream folks to not be like freaked out about like all of this earthy, crunchy stuff. There's very normal plant-based food.
Really, there's some great. And sharing recipes is a wonderful idea. Dr. Thompson, are women at a greater risk for heart disease post-menopause? And if so, why?
We've known for a long time that women's risk rises at age 65, as opposed to men's risk that rises at the age of 55. And we know that there's a complex interplay between the premenopausal hormones and the postmenopausal hormonal state that has significant bearing on the health of the vasculature in our body overall. And so losing the progesterone and estrogen does make significant changes in the way that our arteries function, and the protective qualities of those hormones disappears after menopause. So it's important also to understand that we looked at giving postmenopausal or perimenopausal women hormone replacement therapy as a way to protect against cardiovascular events. And those studies were conducted in the 1990s and stopped early because they actually found that women were having increasing risk of stroke and breast cancer. So there's a very complex interplay between premenopausal hormonal status and postmenopausal hormonal status that increases risk once those hormones are gone.
So, is there anything we can do to reduce that risk once we're, pre or postmenopausal?
Again, we thought, well, if this risk rises with menopause, then we should just replace all those hormones and it's going to make all these women better. And it really doesn't. It's we just have to recognize that this is the hormonal state that we're dealing with, and then aggressively manage all of the other risk factors that we can, and look at our nutrition. Looking at nutrition is the single most important thing that any person can do, no matter what their family history, their hormonal status, whether they're a man or a woman. Looking at nutrition is the major driver of both negative effects and positive effects. So you do have a lot of power in your own hands, to improve your health, even if you are in a menopausal state.
We talked about some of the things to look, when you're going in for your annual exam, and some of the blood work and things. But what about stress tests? Is that something people should be asking for? And if, I mean, at what point in their life or what symptoms, when should you be saying, hey, maybe I need a stress test?
Stress tests are used by cardiologists to determine whether or not you are at high risk for having a cardiac event. So, stress tests, sometimes our patients think of them like mammograms or colonoscopies, like a screening study. And we don't, because heart disease is so much more prevalent than breast cancer or colon cancer, we don't screen for it. We have to look at your risk factors and then what are your symptoms. And symptoms typically drive stress tests. So if anybody ever has any symptoms that are unusual for them that occur with exercise and are alleviated with rest, then we want to do a stress test so we can really see physiologically what's going
What's
on
happening?
when the heart is being tasked with increasing cardiac output because you're exercising.
Are some of the symptoms for heart attack and stroke similar? And how important is it to like get to the emergency room or get medical help ASAP?
So heart attack and stroke, we want to make sure that people are aware of this, symptoms of stroke, which can incur, excuse me, include slurred speech or focal weakness of a part of your body, or drooping of one side of your face, or losing vi vision in one of your eyes. We always want people to be aware that if you're having any of those symptoms, you need to call 911 immediately and get to the nearest hospital where they can assess you and aggressively manage stroke if that's what's occurring. Same with any symptom of heart attack. And again, I can't stress the importance of understanding that the symptoms of heart attack are like a rainbow. Everybody has a little bit different symptoms. So there's typical symptoms and there's just whatever your symptom might be. And again, it could be nausea with exercise or unusual fatigue that only goes away when you stop exercising, chest pain, neck pain, throat pain, arm pain. If you ever think you are having a heart attack, I cannot stress the importance of just calling 911. Don't wait for symptoms to just go away. Don't wait till your husband comes home to drive you someplace. Call 911. That's what they're there for. They can take you safely and rapidly to the nearest hospital so that you can get appropriate assessment and treatment as fast as possible. Because whether you're having a stroke or a heart attack, time is of the essence. And the longer we wait, the more damage and the more permanent damage we can do to those organs.
Right. And also too, I mean, better safe than sorry, right? You maybe it turns out you're just having an anxiety attack or something, but better good to know that, right?
Better to know. Better, you're not bothering anybody. That's what they're there for.
We got about a minute left. Anne, do you have any thoughts that you'd like to pass on to listeners before we let you go?
Well, just to listen to your body, and when, like Dr. Thompson was just saying, don't wait, and see primary care or your cardiologist, and get things addressed so that you can move forward with a healthier day-to-day lifestyle.
Dr. Thompson, final thought?
I think just being aware of your own body and understanding that there are people here on Cape Cod that are here for you, and if you feel that something's going wrong, let somebody know, and we can address it and assess it. And I also want to, thank Anne for her articulate and passionate support of a whole food plant-based diet, because she's really done an amazing thing for herself, and I think she's an example for everybody.
I was going to example for everybody.
Thank
Exactly.
you.
We'll post a link with more information about heart disease at our website, capeandislands.org. Cardiologist Dr. Alyssa Thompson and Anne Sarno, thanks so much for being with us. And Anne, thanks for sharing your story. We really appreciate that.
Thank you.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.